Welcome to Mint and Burn, the academic analysis of blockchain and other technologies in the decentralized digital economy. I'm your host, Kelsey Nabin, and we are tuning in remotely from the RMIT University Blockchain Innovation Hub to bring you expert guests and test frontier ideas. Today, we're joined by Professor Sinclair Davidson, Distinguished Professor Jason Potts, and Professor Chris Berg to discuss blockchain and open source business models. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
So to kick us off, how would you describe the relationship between blockchain, open source, and crypto economics?
That's a great question, Kelsey. I think if we step back and we think about what is one of the core contributions that cryptocurrencies or tokenized value has made for the economy, it's the idea that you can drive business models that are simultaneously open, yet also can be profitable, can support the funding of the development of open source software. Open source software, of course, has been with us for a long time. It's a really critical part of internet infrastructure, and not just infrastructure, but internet culture as well. But it's always been a challenge to fund. With crypto economies, you can actually fund the development of open source software in really interesting and complicated ways.
So the way that I think about it is building on some work done by the MIT management academic Thomas Malone in the early 1990s and even late 1980s, where he put forward this idea of what he called the electronic markets hypothesis. And the argument there was that with what they called in those days ICT revolution, we were actually going to see a lot more market activities taking place as opposed to sort of hierarchical kind of activities taking place. Now, that idea has been around for about 30 years or so, but it didn't really seem to take off at the time. So a lot of people used to look at him and say, gee, you made this great prediction and it didn't really work out. And what was missing from the electronic markets hypothesis, this ability to build more markets and more activities instead of having it go through firms, was the trust criteria. You actually have a lot of local information that you need to communicate out into the world. And to do that, you need a trust mechanism. And that trust mechanism was missing. And so when Satoshi came along and built the first blockchain, he actually industrialized trust. And so all of a sudden, you could actually have what was called the ICT revolution. You could actually have it realizing its potential once you added in blockchain. So the ledger aspect of the blockchain, which everybody now thinks is old hat and passé and all that sort of stuff, the ledger aspect of the blockchain actually adds in a missing ingredient, which allows us to actually build in these business models, which before couldn't be done. So in the open source world, it was always a kind of anybody can come along and pick up the idea and run with it and copy it and all sort of stuff. It was a case of, we're creating these public goods. And in the traditional economics literature, the idea of a public good was that you couldn't appropriate the returns. Well, now all of a sudden, you can actually pick up the value of these network effects, of these positive externalities that have been created. You can actually realize those values. So it is possible now in a blockchain world to build business models on top of open source, which before people kind of really struggled with the idea how could they do that? Well, we now have very, very interesting, innovative ways of doing what people in the past thought couldn't be done or couldn't be done easily.
Sinclair, can I just go back and just with our listeners talk about what we actually mean by business models in the first place, because I think economists and business academic types have a very specific conception of what this means. And the concept of a business model is one of these sort of ideas that has been relatively straightforward and just trivially obvious for hundreds of years through an industrial economy, where you just had a series of production processes. You dig something out of the ground, and the company that does that then adds some cost onto that and charges that. And then this process goes through a whole series of steps until you get to a final consumer who buys the finished product. And that value is sort of cascades back through all of the businesses. that are doing that. And the business model there is you just sell something for more than cost to the next person in the chain. And that industrial era business model ends up with something that we know as shops, with final prices and consumers that buy the thing, and they buy it for a positive price, and that price is larger than everyone else in the chain paid for it. So it's a, you know, that's a business model. You just sell it for more than it costs you to make it.
Yes.
And that industrial era business model has served us well for the last 5,000 years. And then everything got weird when computers came along, and suddenly there was these zero price things in the world because you could create software and digital objects for zero price. You could produce them just purely for the fixed cost of doing it. And then things got dramatically weird there. So the first thing is in a digital world, business models start to look weird. But the second thing is platforms. So a business, a company used to be like a factory. You inputs come in one side, you transform them, you send them out the other side to the customers, which might be another business, right? And then somewhere in the sort of 90s, there emerged this new type of business, which was a company that inside that company was a market. And this is the platform business model, where the business is not making stuff, but bringing people together, matching market, as it were. So Facebook is a platform business. It doesn't have any factories that produce content. You are the content production. But what its business model looks weird from this, you know, take your costs and mark them up and sell them at a positive price perspective, because one side, the customers are getting it everything for free. And you know, what kind of a business model sells something for free and somehow makes money? Answer, one where the other side wants to transact with or meet there. So you end up with these new sort of matching market platform business models, which are, you know, if you go through the list of the top 100 most valuable companies on earth right now, most of them are like this. 20, 30, 40 years ago, none of them were, hardly any of them were. So you've got this two twin things going on. One is digital, where you've got zero price, marginal cost, or non-rivalrous goods, and open sources that as a production process. Then you've also got these companies that inside them are markets. And that the combination of those two things comes together in the crypto space, producing some very, very weird business models. So what we're sort of seeing is this is why business models are hard now, is that they're increasingly complex and weird.
Well, you also got to think about things very differently, because in the old industrial model, there were very clearly consumers and very clearly producers. There were people who made stuff, and then there were people who paid money for that stuff that was made in order to consume it. Whereas in a digital economy, we're all users. So we are simultaneously producers and consumers of product at the same time. And by consuming a product, you're also producing a product. So it's a very, very different way of thinking about how the world actually works. The challenge that we have is that at the same time as the Industrial Revolution occurred, when we had this massification and we built these large hierarchies in order to organize our economy, we also built along with it a series of expectations and a series of regulations and a notion of how the world actually works. So if you look at the discipline of economics, its founder, Adam Smith, is at the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So economists have more or less been trained and socialized into thinking that the industrialized world is actually how the economy really works. And then all of a sudden, you have these platforms coming along where it looks like they're giving away stuff for free. And economists look at this and say, oh my goodness, what is this? How does it work? You know, so we don't even really have the proper tools to analyze what it is that we are looking at. So if you notice, a lot of the economists in the space tend to be more heterodox economists, people who already think slightly out of the mainstream, what Peter Botke calls mainline economics. And the reason they do this is because they don't have that straitjacket in place. So to even look at the crypto world and say, gee, there's something really good going on here. Value has been created. You need to have that heterodox perspective. If you were, or if you're a traditionally trained economist in the neoclassical framework, you look at this and you think, gee, this is dodgy. This is a rort. These people are all criminals. You actually need to have that broader mindscape to look at this and say, gee, this is what's going on here. These are the business models which can work, which can make sense here.
Can I just jump in and just point out that I think that point that Sinclair's made is really, really important. But I'd like to be really precise about it, because there's two major things that have changed over the last couple of decades. The first one is the role of these platform businesses and network effects, which, if you're a regulator, look very peculiar. Network effects obviously mean that an organization economic activity gets better the more people are involved. Now, traditionally, regulators haven't like that. That looks a lot like monopoly, but because of the way network effects function, sometimes, for example, they can completely subsidize one side of the market. So rather than a monopoly bumping up prices, it looks like the prices have gone to zero. This is very confusing from a regulator, and we can talk a lot about that. But the second, so the network effects is the first major thing that's been building basically since the internet. But I think the second one, and this is particularly important for blockchain, is open source, not just ethos, but open source architecture and mechanics. That's not just the fact that we can read code that's on GitHub. It's also that we can read code that is on chain. And so much of our regulatory frameworks are based on an assumption that we might give somebody our money to, we might vouchsafe value with some counterpart in the economy, and they might do something secretly against our interest with those monies. In the blockchain environment, that's impossible, because it's open source and open access, and I can see exactly what happens. I can specify far in advance what is going to occur with my funds. And again, from a regulator's perspective, that's difficult. It's an obvious implication of blockchain that we're going to get a lot more transparency. But as Sinclair said, you know, so economists, regulators, lawyers have been training themselves for literally hundreds of years to look at an economy that operates very, very differently.
Yeah, that's a really insightful perspective, I guess, because you're not just talking about open source code, but you're talking about how the blockchain enables open source business models based off of open source code. And not only is this about kind of creating networks of value and all of those sorts of things, but it's also cultural and ideological around code needs to be verifiable. And also it's creating that trust between peers in a blockchain network that you wouldn't have otherwise. And that's sort of, I guess, why it might be fundamental for blockchain projects to have open source code.
That's absolutely right. Openness is just different, because so much of our regulatory frameworks have been built around this idea that there is asymmetric information between different sides of the market, between buyers who are buying a good or service and sellers who are selling the good or service. What if that asymmetric information was no longer a relevant factor? Now, if that's the case, if we're moving to a decentralized world, there's a lot of work to do to rethink some of the most core regulatory frameworks that govern particularly the financial sector. But I think that's a really clear and obvious implication that I think we're going to be facing up against for decades.
So what are some examples of these business models?
Some examples of the business models are, let me think of a really simple example, and that's DeFi products. So a lot of these DeFi products, if you try to squeeze them into existing regulatory frameworks, in Australia, we would put them into the, they are doing products that would be regulated by the Corporations Act, for example. They might be seen, depending on the nature of them, they might be seen as, say, managed investment schemes under Australia's Corporations Act. Let's say a Uniswap liquidity pool might be viewed as a managed investment scheme. I'm not saying it will, I'm not a lawyer, but it could be. Now that's an interesting observation, but it makes absolutely no sense because the regulations around something like a managed investment scheme are there to protect investors from the opportunistic acts of the people who manage the managed investment schemes. My question is, what if there's no manager? What if there's no central control that might be able to take my money and use it, take an investor's money and use it in a negative way? Now, we've got an entire regulatory framework based around protecting us against the risk that that could happen, but it just can't happen in this particular case. It can't happen in that decentralized, trustless, open system. And if that's the case, well, you know, that creates a huge difficulty for Australian corporations law, but I think it creates a huge difficulty for policymakers to rethink some of their most fundamental assumptions.
And I wonder how these business models are working in practice as well in terms of that accountability. Have you heard of any experience of that in terms of, I guess, consumer protection is really the goal of regulation in these cases?
Yeah, so I mean, I think what's going on here is it's not just the consumer protection and regulation side. We're just trying to answer the question, how do we make things safe here? I mean, the great sort of thing that open source software really innovated in a digital world was this idea of peer production, or the idea that there's not producers over here making the stuff and consumers over there using the stuff. It's much more like a co-op. Where you've got a bunch of people that are simultaneously producers and consumers in the same thing. And like in many ways, that's what open source software is from a production perspective, is this idea that everyone who's using it is also can also feedback information into the production process. So it's a far more cooperative joint production process. Now, what that does is it separates this distinction between consumers over there that have, you know, consumer rights that need to be protected and information asymmetries, as Chris was talking about. They're actually part of the process, but they're not shareholders or owners. It's not like you've got a bunch of providers of finance over here that have a different set of rights. It's basically this big jumble soup of rights and responsibilities and joint production as a community. And you know, that was the world that open source software introduced, but it did so using community social governance. There wasn't really any strong property rights in that world, or there wasn't really any strong cross payments or technologies of sort of keeping track of things other than sort of Web 1, Web 2 type technologies of just being able to track who did what when, you know, in a reputation economy sort of sense. Whereas what we've got now is that cultural ethos of open production, that we build this transparently together as a community, and we build it for us. The producers are the consumers, are the users, and that world of having everyone sort of involved in the production process again is a thing that is just native in the crypto space, but that came from somewhere. That was open source culture. But this is sort of why you have now this concern with the qualities and strength of the community, or how good is the community, or how engaged is the community. Because that becomes a key part of this story. But as sort of Chris was saying, in that world, you don't need a regulator to look out for anything, because everyone is already doing that to each other. They're looking out for each other. They're monitoring each other. Now that gives you a new set of challenges around scaling, and you know, how do we grow this in such a way that it extends, that we can extend it beyond that trusted insider community of people that are both producing and consuming, and you know, usually have a fairly high level of technical capabilities. So I think a lot of that is still relatively new in terms of, you know, what do we need to make this work? Do we need more regulatory governance or less? Do we need more community management or less? Or do we need more higher powered incentives for participation? And the big one, though, I think is actually, and the big one that started all of this was financing. This idea that you know, in the industrial world, finance is a separate profession. Those that accumulate savings, supply those savings to companies to invest in capital and whatever, and they're separate shareholders with with a specific set of rights associated with that. But they're providing inputs into the business. They're not consumers. They're not managers. They're an input supplier, finance. ICOs in crypto just blew that out of the water. And for the first time, and we didn't see this with open source, because open source was you contribute in time. I put my time into the project, or my eyeballs and effort and so on. Whereas what crypto opened up was this ability to contribute finance by bringing in, I'm going to bring in some of my capital from the world. I'm going to move it into crypto, and I'm going to buy a, it's not a share in the business. I'm participating now. I own
some. It's like a ticket.
It's a participation right.
Yeah, and it's but that's the thing. Like, it
comes back to the notion that we are simultaneously producers and consumers, and we are simultaneously suppliers of finance, suppliers of effort. So it's sort of taking us away from the old silos. You know, here were the workers, here are the financiers, here are the suppliers, here are the whatever. And what the entrepreneur did or the business person did was they entered into this nexus of contracts with all of these different groups, and we had hard and soft contracts and what have you, where all of a sudden we don't have that point of centralization there that needs to coordinate a lot of activity, because we cooperate. So we actually move away from a coordination model to a cooperation model. And we simultaneously, we may be financiers, we may be sweat equity people, we may be developers, you know. So it kind of blurs a lot of those industrial distinctions that we had before. So in the industrial model, we have the management, we have the shareholders, where they end up getting the residual because they are the risk takers in this nexus of contracts. Whereas in these new business models, we have this value that's been generated and been thrown off, and that can then be captured in a way via tokens or some other mechanism, and it's developing that capture of the value which gets thrown off, which is actually the way in which we think about the business models now. So it's not a case of you do this, I do that, I check up on you and I take off the surplus kind of affair. We actually have this cooperation where Ludwig von Mises famously said the market is cooperation under the division of labor. Well, in the blockchain space, that is exactly what we have, but it's no longer just a market, it's now a business model.
And I think it's interesting to think about the evolution of the meanings of token ownership in this context. Bitcoin, to hold Bitcoin gives you no specific governance rights. Bitcoin holders don't have any particular control over the network unless they're full economic nodes. Ethereum doesn't strictly give you any governance rights over the network as well, but almost every major project that's come since has had some structure around the governance rights that holding a token would give you. And that makes sense. I think that's where we have ended up, because we have learned over the last 10 years that to hold tokens in a project, whether that's Bitcoin or some niche DeFi project, is to join that community. And to join that community, whether you're an investor, whether you're just providing capital, whether you're whether you're part of the community, whether you're a developer, whatever it is, whether you're writing content on the internet, whether you're just tweeting constantly, is to have some sort of governance interest in these communities. And I think it has made sense, but it doesn't fit, as Sinclair is saying, it doesn't fit any of our traditional understandings of what it means to be a shareholder or management or customer or client in a traditional economy. You're just part of a community in a way that is increasingly concrete. Normally we talk about communities as these wishy-washy concepts where you're never sure what the boundary is. We know what the boundary is of a cryptocurrency community. The blockchain community, they're the people who own the tokens. And I think that's that evolution of the communal structure is really, really interesting and has some pretty important implications for the future.
I think just building on that, I mean, what we're seeing then is evolution of business models and this process of entrepreneurial discovery of new types of business models. And you know, this is not new. Like we've had this before with the invention of, say, franchising or the invention of you know, timeshares or whatever, but just new ways of extracting value by sort of changing the price where you, the point at which you capture value. What's incredible in the crypto space in the past sort of 10 years is just we've got 1,000 years worth of experimentation has been compressed into this very, very short period of time. It's like a Cambrian explosion of variety of just the craziest ideas of things. And that sort of rich design space or that rich palette of opportunities is just simply because it's a software, this is digital. We've got a whole lot of you know, it's cheap to experiment. There's lots of possibilities of having zero price points all through it, and then you'd capture it somewhere else. Never before have we had this combination of cheap experimentation, low cost, or just very easily composable business elements where you can just mix and match them to you know, business Legos, if you will, to put that together in a space that is simultaneously happening across multiple industry sectors and finance and supply chains, whatever, that is simultaneously happening under a I want to say weak regulatory oversight regime, or just regulators are struggling to keep up. They'll catch you eventually, but there's a period of time where you can just try anything before anyone even figures out what it is. You see this. I think one of the most beautiful parts of this right now is the NFT space, where just anything goes. There's just wild experimentation. Everyone's having a great time, and incredibly, some just, you know, billion-dollar conjectures about how to create a business have just grown up. That look seemingly absurd on the face of it. Just we're going to start. You know, I'm thinking of things like Loot in this instance, where you just start by just throwing out some property rights over the inputs to a game. That's it. That's the business model. We'll sell those. We'll see what happens. Wildly successful.
And, you see, because yeah. that builds off the human imagination. The Loot story. Because more or less, here is a thing, and can you imagine that thing being different? And so what is happening in the Loot world is that people are adding their imagination into these objects and then building them up. So it's not in the old days you would read a book and then you'd see the movie and you'd be saying, oh, I'm so disappointed, because what the real world confronted your imagination was completely different. What is happening in the Loot world is that the real world is your imagination, that magic axe, that leather jerkin, that whatever it is actually your imagination, and you can build communities around shared imagination.
It's a communal imagination in that sense.
Yes.
And a communal imagination structured around an NFT, a shared token, or what have you.
Yes. And that's where DAOs come in, is how we organize our shared imagination as to what it is that we are doing. Now, if you go back to the shop analogy that Jason was talking about before, in the old days, when you opened up a shop, the first thing you would do is that you would put in the decor that you'd want. So you would often see, you know, carpenters and people in shops putting in decor and what have you. And then a few months later, if the business failed, there'd be another set of carpenters putting in new decor and all this sort of stuff. That's actually very expensive. The fixed costs of building a business in the industrialized economy was high. The fixed cost of building a business in the digital space is actually quite low, because it's been built off general purpose technologies, you know, computers and then open source. So the cost of actually opening up your business is the marginal cost is close to zero. It's more or less your own time and effort. And of course, in the open source world, you've got all these other people who are going to come in who share your imagination, and the tyranny of distance and geography in your business is totally gone as well. You know, when I did undergraduate economics, you used to have these, you know, transport costs that you'd build in with these cost curves. Now, more or less, anybody with a connection to the internet can interact with users anywhere in the world. And there is somewhere somebody else in the world who shares your imagination as to this leather jerk and magic axe, whatever it is. So all of a sudden you are cooperating with people anywhere in the world at any time using a very low cost technology. So the network effects and the positive externalities are huge. And all you have, well, not all, I mean, I don't want to say it sounds like nothing, but what you have to do is come up with a mechanism of capturing that value. And that is the challenge, the business challenge in the space, is coming up with value or ways to capture that value, which I have to say, before Satoshi, couldn't be done. It was very difficult. You know, whenever we had positive externalities, we'd say, oh, you know, we have to have the government, or we have to have centralization, or we have to have clubs. This is even, democratizing is not quite the word, but this is even democratizing clubs and club goods and putting value into them that can be captured by all the users.
So if a business model depends on the strength and quality of a community, how can projects be thinking about building community? And then what are some concrete examples where you've seen that value captured beyond, I guess, the conjecture of the example of Loot, which is like, we'll put it out there, we'll see what happens, and we'll make up the rest of the system later?
I think you've got to... I'm going to sort of sketch some broad ideas here and then let Jason and Chris jump in. The way that we go about it, first of all, is thinking of the economic model, or very often what we call the tokenomics. So in the same way which you have a traditional business, you have to think of, what are the supply and demand conditions here? What are the group of people that you are bringing together? What is the idea? What is the product? What is the thing? What is the object? So I think you need to get that right first. And then on top of that, you then need to think, okay, once we've got the supply and demand conditions, the economic model, how do we fit in a business model on top of that? And one of the great ways of doing this is building off the flywheel idea. So what is your flywheel? What starts the flywheel turning? Where are the network effects? Where are the positive externalities being generated? How are they being generated? Then you think about, okay, how can we capture them? So you do need to think long and hard about what is the product, and then you have to think long and hard about, and when I say what is the product, I don't like the cynical way which people describe, say, Facebook, for example, where they say, if you can't see the product, you are the product. Yes, you are the product, but in a positive way. You are co-producing value in the system. So where is this value being co-produced? What is the value? How do you capture it in a flywheel? And then, of course, bearing in mind all of this is open source and very transparent, you can't put in arbitrary fees. You know, you can't charge people necessarily for walking in the door. So you've actually got to have you take a fee, you take a charge, and all the sort of stuff where people are genuinely participating, wanting to participate, and can walk out the door and can fork you if they're really unhappy but they like your product. You know, so you can't treat people badly. This is a purely voluntary system in terms of people cooperating.
Look, it's a really interesting question. How do you build a community? And I think we've seen examples of, we've seen lots of examples of successful and unsuccessful communities. But I think we've learned a lot about how to do so over the last couple of years, particularly over the last 18 months. And the example that comes to mind immediately is Uniswap and SushiSwap. So when SushiSwap forked the Uniswap model and released a token on top of it, I know there's some dispute about whether it was just a blind copy and paste, but let's just for argument's sake say that it was just a clean fork with a token on top. And that was controversial. Obviously, there were some issues around how its treasury was managed. But now SushiSwap is actually an incredibly thriving community, not least in part because it launched with a token. And that token became a point at which people rallied around. Even if they were only small token holders, they would get excited by the project because they felt like they had some sort of ownership stake. We're seeing this debate happen a lot right now when we talk about the layer twos for Ethereum. Will all layer twos ultimately have their own native token? How are they going to try to fund their ongoing development and research? How are they going to build communities around that? Again, we see the same thing in the NFT space. Will OpenSea launch a token or not? And I think ultimately, the lesson that we can draw over the last couple of years is that almost every project will launch a token because almost every project wants to be able to coordinate a community around that token. Fundamentally, a token is a social coordination tool. It's what excited us all most about these technologies when we first got involved in studying blockchain and cryptocurrency. And I think it remains a really, really fundamental part of the value proposition of the sector.
I think one of the key things that we saw very early on, I think anyone who's been in this space for a while sort of starts to sort of feel in their bones, is that these aren't companies that are being built. A lot of the crypto we describe them as projects in a very explicit way, or communities. And I think the way that we think of them is their economies. In the sense that when any of these projects aren't, you know, how do I build my factory and where do I put my, the loading bays that for the stuff that comes in, and then the display room for the stuff that goes out, and you know, what we've got here is these projects are a group of people want to create value by cooperating to do this thing. That's an economy, and what you need for that is you need fundamental sort of governance rules, and you need identity control, you know, ways of tracking who, you need ways of doing internal payments because we need the money. We need to design the incentives so that we get the things that we all want. That's the sort of price, internal pricing or tokenomics. That's what tokenomics really is in that system. Then we need ways of just keeping track of ownership and how other people can join this economy or this, you know, this community. So this notion, you know, for economists, this is the field of macroeconomics, or you know, institutional economics, or the sort of, you know, big, you know, the study of entire economies. And we normally think of those as incredibly complicated things that take years and years or decades or centuries to try and do. That once you've got the infrastructure in place, it lasts forever. Whereas this is now a Tuesday morning project, is we need to build our money. And then on Wednesday, we'll build some identity protocols. And on Thursday, we'll figure out what the whole capital structure of the thing looks like. And on Friday, we'll do foreign policy. We'll figure out how we're going to bridge over to Cosmos, whatever. But that sort of way of seeing this is we're building and designing economies, not businesses. So when we say, I think the very concept of business models is slightly misleading in that sense, that it implies that it's an industrial business that's got a shop and selling stuff to a consumer, and then there's, you know, owners in the background or whatever. Whereas what this is just, you know, a small number, but increasingly every day there's new economies emerging into the space. And that, you know, and so it's not weird that there's this, you know, just flourishing of number of monies or a number of property rights. That's a sign of success, not of confusion. Whereas like normal industrial era businesses all use the same money, and they use the same property rights system. They're all running on the same, you know, creaky infrastructure.
But the industrial businesses all use the same money, but they all had their own internal accounting systems. So internal to them, they had these accounting systems which they denominated in sort of fiat, what have you. But in actual fact, every local community has its own ledger system. Sometimes this is the book, sometimes this is people's memories. And what we now have is communities anchoring around their own internal system, which becomes their own token. And human beings have been doing this for thousands of years. And so in many ways, we are actually going back to our natural way of coordinating and working together as humans. And it's just that the Industrial Revolution sort of put us all into these very rigid hierarchies that unfortunately or fortunately, we have grown to believe is the natural order of the world. In actual fact, human beings cooperating in this fluid way is the natural way of the world. And we interact with different communities for different purposes all the time. So I actually think that we will very quickly in the blockchain, in the crypto space, give vent to our natural human innate behaviors, which is why I think it is taking off, why it is doing so well. And I kind of think a lot of the digital world will very quickly become a legacy world. There are some things that we will need hierarchies to coordinate with, and we will continue doing that. But where markets can supplant hierarchies, given this trust industrialization which we have, that is going to happen very, very quickly. And I just kind of think I think it was Bill Gates who kind of said that, you know, we overestimate what's going to happen in the next 2 years, but we underestimate what's going to happen in the next 10 years. I think the world that we're living in now, I mean, even before COVID, is very different from the world was 10 years ago. And the world we're going to be living in 10 years' time is going to be very different from what the world is now. There's going to be a massive explosion. This is going to mainstream very, very quickly.
So to that point, is there competition in these economies? And if so, how do you protect your competitive edge? Like, it's been very interesting to see some open source projects kind of, you know, copyright, for example, their IP, where they are getting copied by a whole lot of other projects.
Look, that is just an incredibly important question. And we, when we do a lot of crypto economic design, we are asked a lot about this. There is no competitive moat here in an open source environment. I'm very familiar with these attempts to try to copyright different innovations, but it's very difficult to do so if you are also simultaneously publishing those innovations, communicating those innovations to an open market, and doing so in a borderless, decentralized environment, for the same reason that these technologies are censorship resistant from governments. They are also censorship resistant by people trying to protect a monopoly. There is no other answer in this environment, then you have to keep innovating faster than every other competitor. You just have to keep pushing forward. We can try to architect barriers to competition, but ultimately, because of not just the pace of change, but also the structures around that change, the way those changes occur, you just have to be better and faster. There is no sleeping in the crypto economy. You just got to, you know, push really, really hard. Demoralizing answer for a lot of people, I'm sure, but incredibly exciting if you're an economist.
Yeah, exhilarating answer. Exhilarating. Yes. I just love it.
But I think, I mean, what this is this is the innovation economy, right? This is what the innovation economy looks like in a digital world. And I think so. Everything Chris said is absolutely right. This is and will be thus forever in a globalized context. But the other thing that's going on here, and sometimes this gets lost, there's a fundamental transition from a property rights system that we've had for the last 400 years, where we relied on government registries and courts to enforce property rights that enabled us to create scarcities, or we used licensing systems to create monopolies and, you know, other ways of creating rents in the economy through that. What we're shifting away from is, instead of using intellectual property to govern idea scarcity and control of those rents, we're shifting to a world in which that claim of ownership of property rights, of I own this because I've got it here, that is baked natively into blockchain. And that sort of shift of the foundation of property rights sitting with government to the foundations of property rights sitting with a protocol, that's the sort of shift that's happening. And we're building new business models or designing new economies in a world, you know, property rights are fundamental at the basis of any economy. When you go right to the bottom, where it bottoms out is I own this, and you don't, and therefore I have rights over it, and every economies and markets and everything else is built on that. And this fundamental shift in the technology and architecture institutions of property rights is what has happened. Now, one of the key points about this, in answer to the question, why is a crypto digital platform protocol property rights system better, is it's massively cheaper. It runs faster. You can spin it up. It's more flexible. You can just do way more things with it. The very first thing that happened was we got property rights over all sorts of weird new stuff. Previously, it was land, cars, maybe my cattle, you know, and that you have, you know, and anything you've got a receipt for, maybe, but pretty, you know, low quality property rights that a lot of value is resting on. Now, just limited by imagination. So that sort of entrepreneurial exploration of what can I attach property rights to? Now, again, we don't say attach property rights, we say tokenize, right? That's the word that means the same thing. Yes. And that's the idea of being able to tokenize down to 17 decimal places means I can attach some really specific, wildly just computable property rights on all sorts of weird stuff that doesn't even exist. Bang, a word. Got it, NFT. And I think that's what we're living through right now people say it's an explosion of blockchain and crypto and digital economy. Yes, but what it is an exploration of what it means when property rights are cheap and easy to use for just anything you can think of. And that's sort of why this looks like a sort of market-driven revolution. It's this explosion of markets, this explosion of exchanges, and why we're seeing so many of the crypto companies now are infrastructure companies building property rights institutions, markets for exchange, money for accounting of that system. These are all sort of institutions to facilitate this explosion of new types of property rights that work at a global galactic scale over things that aren't just physical stuff, stuff you can touch and poke, you know, houses, cars, cows, but just over everything, anything you can think of. And also, and again, with things like DAOs, we can slice this. It's not I own this, it's we own this. Who's we? Well, today it's this particular group because they've got the governance tokens. How many of them are? There's 12,000 of them, and these are their names. I've never met any of them, but we own this thing. And just this weird, exciting new explosion of ownership, of enormously complex ownership and enormously complex attachment of that to just all of the things in the world. That's what's creating this explosion of new types of economies. Now, into this world enters, you know, the question we started with: what are business models in this space? Why is it so hard and strange and unusual? Because the economy underneath it just got weird and strange and unusual, but in an explosion of richness. There's just so much more of it there now than ever before. And we're going through this process of trying to figure out what types of business models work in that new world. And one of the first things we're realizing is that most of the previous ones...
The economic resources in an industrial economy are land, labor, capital. The economic resources in a crypto economy is the human imagination. Our human capital has suddenly become the most valuable thing that we've got. And if we can tokenize that, and that's what's happening, we are tokenizing our imaginations. We can tokenize that and drive value and capture value from that. That is the future of the crypto economy. That is where the value is. That is the business model. We are really trying to grapple with and understand, and then of course roll it out. That's the thing.
Such a dynamic conversation, and I know we could keep discussing these ideas for a long time, and I'm sure that we will. But I'm really excited to share this podcast, and have very much enjoyed hearing not just your ideas on this, but also the progression of ideas as the space evolves and innovates and people do kind of let loose that imagination. So I'll rename the podcast Building Open Source Blockchain Economies based on that conversation and pause here by wrapping up. So thank you to our guests, Sinclair, Jason and Chris, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Mint and Burn. You can check out the show notes and get in touch if you have ideas or feedback on the podcast at rmitblockchain.io.